8. That to which his fiancée was so indifferent produced on Lujan an impression nobody could have foreseen. He visited the famous apartment in which the very air seemed colored with phony folklore, immediately after obtaining his first point by defeating an extremely tenacious Hungarian. The game, it is true, had been postponed after 40 moves, but the continuation was perfectly clear to Lujan. To a faceless taxi driver, he read aloud the address on the postcard.
"We've come, Zhidzhim vas vicharam, expecting you this evening."
And having imperceptibly surmounted the dim accidental distance, he cautiously tried to pull the ring out of the lion's jaws. The bell leapt into action immediately. The door flew open.
"What? No overcoat? I won't let you in."
But he had already stepped over the threshold and was waving his arm and shaking his head in an attempt to overcome his shortness of breath.
"Poof! Poof!"
he gasped, preparing himself for a wonderful embrace, and then suddenly noticed that his left hand, already extended to one side, held an unnecessary cane, and his right, his billfold, which he had evidently been carrying since he paid his taxi fare.
"Wearing that black monster of a hat again. Well, why are you standing there? This way."
His cane dived safely into a vase-like receptacle. His billfold, at the second thrust, found the right pocket, and his hat was hung on a hook.
"Here I am," said Lujan. "Whoof, whoof."
She was already far away at the far end of the entrance hall. She pushed a door sidewise, her bare arm extended along the jamb, bending her head and gaily looking up at Lujan. And over the door, immediately over the lintel, there was a large, vivid oil painting that caught the eye. Lujan, who normally did not notice such things, gave his attention to it because it was greasily glossed with electric light, and the colors dazed him like a sunstroke. A village girl in a red kerchief coming down to her eyebrows was eating an apple, and her black shadow on a fence was eating a slightly larger apple.
"A Russian baba,"
said Lujan with relish, and laughed.
"Well, come in, don't upset that table."
He entered the drawing room and went all limp with pleasure, and his stomach, beneath the velvet waistcoat that for some reason he always wore during tournaments, quivered touchingly with laughter. A chandelier with pale translucent pendants answered him with an oddly familiar vibration, and on the yellow parquetry that reflected the legs of Empire armchairs, a white bearskin with spread paws lay in front of the piano, as if flying in the shiny abyss of the floor. All sorts of festive-looking knick-knacks were on numerous small tables, shelves, and consoles, while something resembling big, heavy rubles gleamed silver in a cabinet, and a peacock feather stuck out from behind the frame of a mirror. And there were lots of pictures on the walls, more country girls in flowered kerchiefs, a golden bogatir on a white draft horse, log cabins beneath blue featherbeds of snow. All this, for Lujan, merged into an affecting glitter of color, from which a separate object would momentarily leap out, a porcelain moose or a dark-eyed icon, and then again there would be that gay rippling in his eyes, and the polar skin which he tripped over, causing one edge to reverse, turned out to have a scalloped red lining. It was more than 10 years since he had been in a Russian home, and now, finding himself in a house where a gaudy Russia was boldly put on display, he experienced a childish elation, a desire to clap his hands. Never in his life had he felt so cozy and so at ease.
"Left over from Easter,"
he said with conviction, pointing with his auricular finger at a large gold-patterned wooden egg, a tombola prize from a charity ball. At that moment, a white double-leafed door burst open, and a very upright gentleman with his hair en brosse and a pince-nez came swiftly into the room, one hand already stretched out.
"Welcome," he said. "Pleased to meet you."
Here, like a conjurer, He opened a handmade cigarette case that had an Alexander I eagle on the lid.
"With mouthpieces," said Luzhin, squinting at the cigarettes. "I don't smoke that kind, but look."
He began to burrow in his pockets, extracting some thick cigarettes that were spilling from a paper pack. He dropped several of them, and the gentleman nimbly picked them up.
"My pet," he said,
"get us an ashtray, please. Take a seat. Excuse me, I don't know your name and patronymic." A crystal ashtray came down between them, and simultaneously dipping their cigarettes, they knocked the ends together.
"Jadub,"
said the chess player good-naturedly, straightening his bent cigarette.
"Never mind, never mind," said the other quickly, and expelled two thin streams of smoke through the nostrils of his suddenly narrowed nose. "Well, here you are in our good old Berlin. My daughter tells me you came for a contest."
He freed a starched cuff, placed one hand on his hip, and continued,
"By the way, I have always wondered, is there a move in chess that always enables one to win? I don't know if you understand me, but what I mean is, sorry, your name and patronymic?"
"I understand," said Luzhin,
conscientiously considering for a moment.
"You see, we have quiet moves and strong moves. A strong move..."
"Ah, yes, yes, so that's it," nodded the gentleman.
"A strong move is one that,"
continued Luzhin, loudly and enthusiastically,
"that immediately gives us an undoubted advantage. A double check, for example, with the taking of a heavyweight piece, or say, when a pawn is queened, etc., etc., and a quiet move..."
"I see, I see," said the gentleman. "About how many days will the contest last?"
"A quiet move implies trickery, subversion, complication," said Luzhin,
trying to please, but also entering into the spirit of things.
"Let's take some position, white."
He pondered, staring at the ashtray.
"Unfortunately," said his host nervously, "I don't understand anything about chess. I only asked you, but that does not matter at all, at all. In a moment we'll proceed to the dining room. Tell me, my pet, is tea ready?"
"Yes," exclaimed Luzhin. "We'll simply take the endgame position at the point it was interrupted today. White, king, c3, rook, a1, knight, d5, pawns, b3 and c4, black."
"A complicated thing, chess," interjected the gentleman, and jumped buoyantly to his feet,
trying to cut off the flood of letters and numbers having some kind of relation to black.
"Let us suppose now," said Luzhin weightily, "that black makes the best possible move in this position, e6 to g5. To this, I reply with the following quiet move."
Luzhin narrowed his eyes, and almost in a whisper, pursing his lips as for a careful kiss, emitted not words, not the mere designation of a move, but something most tender and infinitely fragile. The same expression was on his face, the expression of a person blowing a tiny feather from the face of an infant, when the following day he embodied this move on the board. The Hungarian, sallow-cheeked after a sleepless night, during which he had managed to check all the variations leading to a draw, but had failed to notice just this one hidden combination, sank into deep meditation over the board, while Luzhin, with a finicky little cough, lovingly noted his own move on a sheet of paper. The Hungarian soon resigned, and Luzhin sat down to play with a Russian. The game began interestingly, and soon a solid ring of spectators had formed around their table. The curiosity, the pressure, the crackling of joints, the alien breathing, and most of all the whispering interrupted by a still louder and more irritating shush, frequently tormented Luzhin. He used to be keenly affected by this crackling and rustling and smelly human warmth, if he did not retreat too deeply into the abysses of chess. Out of the corner of his eye, he now saw the legs of the bystanders, and found particularly irritating among all those dark trousers a pair of woman's feet in gleaming gray stockings and bluish shoes. These feet obviously understood nothing of the game. One wondered why they had come. Those pointed shoes with transverse straps or something would be better clicking along the sidewalk as far away as possible from here. While stopping his clock, jotting down a move or putting a captured piece aside, he would glance askance at these motionless feminine feet, and only an hour and a half later, when he had won the game and stood up, tugging his waistcoat down, did Lucien see that these feet belonged to his fiancée. He experienced a keen sense of happiness that she had been there to see him win, and he waited avidly for the chessboards and all these noisy people to disappear in order the sooner to caress her. But the chessboards did not disappear immediately, and even when the bright dining room appeared together with its huge, brassy, bright samovar, indistinct regular squares showed through the white tablecloth, and similar squares, chocolate and cream ones, were indubitably there on the frosted cake. His fiancée's mother met him with the same condescending, slightly ironic indulgence with which she had greeted him the night before, when her appearance had put an end to the conversation about chess, and the person with whom he had talked, her husband evidently, now started to tell him what a model country estate he had owned in Russia.
"Let's go to your room,"
whispered Lucien hoarsely to his betrothed, and she bit her lip and looked surprised.
"Let's go,"
he repeated, but she adroitly placed some heavenly raspberry jam on his glass plate, and this sticky, dazzlingly red sweetness, which ran over the tongue like granular fire and gummed the teeth with fragrant sugar, took immediate effect.
"Merci, merci,"
Lucien bowed as he was served a second helping, and amid deathly silence smacked his lips again, licking his spoon that was still hot from the tea, for fear of losing even a single drop of the entrancing syrup. And when finally he got his own way and found himself alone with her, not, it is true, in her room, but in the gaudy drawing-room, he drew her to him and sat down heavily, holding her by the wrists. But she silently freed herself, circled, and sat down on a hassock.
"I have not at all made up my mind yet whether to marry you," she said. "Remember that."
"Everything's decided," said Lucien. "If they won't let you, we'll use force to make them sign."
"Sign what?" she asked with surprise.
"I don't know, but it seems we need some kind of signature or other."
"Stupid, stupid," she repeated several times. "Impenetrable and incorrigible stupidity. What am I to do with you? What course of action shall I take with you? And how tired you look. I'm sure it's bad for you to play so much."
"Ach, wo," said Lucien, "a couple of little games."
"And at night you keep thinking. You mustn't do it. It's already late, you know. Go home. You need sleep, that's what."
He remained sitting on the striped sofa, however, and she thought in dismay about the kind of conversations they had, a poke here, a dab there, and disconnected words. And not once so far had he kissed her properly. All was bizarre and distorted. And when he touched her, not a single movement of his resembled a normal human embrace. But that forlorn devotion in his eyes, that mysterious light that had illumined him when he bent over the chessboard, and the following day she again felt the urge to visit those silent premises on the second floor of a large café on a narrow, noisy street. This time, Lucian noticed her at once. He was conversing in low tones with a broad-shouldered, clean-shaven man whose short-cropped hair seemed to have been closely fitted to his head and came down onto his forehead in a small peak. His thick lips were infolding and sucking an extinguished cigar. An artist who had been sent by his newspaper, lifting and lowering his face like a brass doll with a movable head, was swiftly sketching the profile with the cigar. Glancing at his pad as she passed, she saw next to this rudimentary Turati an already completed Lucian, exaggeratedly doleful nose, dark-stippled double chin, and on the temple that familiar lock which she called a curl. Turati sat down to play with a German grandmaster, and Lucian came up to her and gloomily, with a guilty smile, said something long and clumsy. She realized with surprise that he was asking her to leave.
"I'm glad, I'm very glad post factum," explained Lucian pleadingly, "but for the moment, it somehow disturbs me."
He followed her with his eyes as she obediently withdrew between the rows of chess tables, and after nodding briskly to himself, he made his way to the board where his new opponent was already seating himself, a grizzled Englishman who played with invariable sang-froid and invariably lost. Neither was he lucky this time, and Lucian again won a point. And the next day he achieved a draw, and then again won, and by that time he no longer felt distinctly the boundary between chess and his fiancée's home, as if movement had been speeded up, and what at first had seemed an alternation of strips was now a flicker. He moved in step with Turati. Turati scored a point, and he scored a point. Turati scored a half, and he scored a half. Thus they proceeded with their separate games, as if mounting the sides of an isosceles triangle and destined at the decisive moment to meet at the apex. The nights were somehow bumpy. He just could not manage to force himself not to think of chess, and although he felt drowsy, sleep could find no way into his brain. It searched for a loophole, but every entrance was guarded by a chess sentry, and he had the agonizing feeling that sleep was just there, close by, but on the outside of his brain. The Lucian, who was wearily scattered around the room, slumbered, but the Lucian who visualized a chessboard stayed awake and was unable to merge with his happy double. But still worse, after each session of the tournament, it was with ever greater difficulty that he crawled out of the world of chess concepts, so that an unpleasant split began to appear, even in daytime. After a 3-hour game, his head ached strangely, not all of it, but in parts, in black squares of pain. And for a while, he could not find the door, which was obscured by a black spot. Nor could he remember the address of the cherished house. Luckily, his pocket still preserved that old postcard, folded in two, and already tearing along the crease. Vas vecherum, expecting you this evening. He still continued to feel joy when he entered this house filled with Russian toys, but the joy, too, was spotty. Once, on a day with no play, he came earlier than usual when only the mother was at home. She decided to continue the conversation that had taken place at sunset in the beach coppice, and overestimating her own highly prized ability to speak her mind, for which the young men who visited their house considered her tremendously intelligent and were very much afraid of her, she swooped on Lucian, lecturing him first of all on the cigarette butts found in all the vases, and even in the jaws of the spread-eagled bear, and then suggested that there and then, this Saturday evening, he take a bath at their place after her husband had finished his own weekly ablutions. "I dare say you don't wash often," she said without circumlocution. "Not too often, admit it now." Lucian gloomily shrugged his shoulders, looking at the floor, where a slight movement was taking place perceptible to him alone, an evil differentiation of shadows.
"And in general," she continued, "you must pull yourself together."
And having thus put her hearer in the right mood, she went on to the main subject.
"Tell me," she asked, "I imagine you've managed to debauch my little girl thoroughly. People like you are great lechers. But my daughter is chaste, not like today's girls. Tell me, you're a lecher, aren't you?"
"No, madame," replied Lucian with a sigh.
And then he frowned and quickly drew the sole of his shoe over the floor, obliterating a certain grouping that was already quite distinct.
"Why, I don't know you at all," continued the swift, sonorous voice. "I shall have to make inquiries about you. Yes, yes, inquiries, to see if you haven't one of those special diseases."
"Shortness of breath," said Lucian, "and also a bit of rheumatism."
"I'm not talking about that," she interrupted crossly. "It's a serious matter. You evidently consider yourself engaged. You come here and you spend time alone with her, but I don't think there can be any talk of marriage for a while."
"And last year I had the piles," said Lucian dully.
"Listen, I'm talking to you about extremely important things. You would probably like to get married today, right away. I know you. Then she'll be going about with a big belly. You'll brutalize her immediately."
Having stamped out a shadow in one place, Lucian saw with despair that far from where he was sitting, a new combination was taking shape on the floor.
"If you are in the least interested in my opinion, then I must tell you I consider this match ridiculous. You probably think my husband will support you. Admit it, you do think that?"
"I am in straitened circumstances," said Lucian. "I would need very little, and a magazine has offered me to edit its chess section."
Here, the nuisances on the floor became so brazen that Lucian involuntarily put out a hand to remove Shadow's king from the threat of Light's pawn. From that day on, he avoided sitting in that drawing room where there were too many knick-knacks of polished wood that assumed very definite features if you looked at them long enough. His fiancée noticed that with each day of the tournament, he looked worse and worse. His eyes were ringed with dull violet, and his heavy lids were inflamed. He was so pale that he always seemed ill-shaven, although on his fiancée's insistence he shaved every morning. She awaited the end of the tournament with great impatience, and it pained her to think what fabulous, harmful exertions he had to make to gain each point. Poor Lucian, mysterious Lucian. All through those autumn days, while playing tennis in the mornings with a German girlfriend, or listening to lectures on art that had long since palled on her, or leafing through a tattered assortment of books in her room, Andreev's The Ocean, a novel by Krasnov, and a pamphlet entitled How to Become a Yogi, she was conscious that right now Lucian was immersed in chess calculations, struggling and suffering, and it vexed her that she was unable to share in the torments of his art. She believed in his genius unconditionally, and was convinced, moreover, that this genius could not be exhausted by the mere playing of chess, however wonderful it might be, and that when the tournament fever had passed and Lucian had calmed down, he would rest, and within him some kind of still unfathomed forces would come into play, and he would blossom out and display his gift in other spheres of life as well. Her father called Lucian a narrow fanatic, but added that he was undoubtedly a very naive and very respectable person. Her mother, on the other hand, maintained that Lucian was going out of his mind, not by the day, but by the hour,
and that lunatics were forbidden by law to marry. And she concealed the inconceivable fiancé from all her friends, which was easy at first. They thought she was at the resort with her daughter. But then, very soon, there reappeared all those people who usually frequented their house, such as a charming old general who always maintained that it was not Russia we expatriates regretted, but youth, youth. A couple of Russian Germans, Oleg Sergeyevich Smirnovsky, theosophist and proprietor of a liqueur factory, several former officers of the White Army, several young ladies, the singer, Madame Vozvesensky, the Alfiorov couple, and also the aged Princess Umanov, whom they called the Queen of Spades after the well-known opera. She it was who was the first to see Luzhin, concluding from a hasty and unintelligible explanation by the mistress of the house that he had some kind of connection with literature, with magazines, was, in a word, an author. "And that thing, do you know it?" she asked, politely striking up a literary conversation. "From Apuchtin, one of the new poets, slightly decadent, something about yellow and red cornflowers?" Smirnovsky lost no time in asking him for a game of chess, but unfortunately there proved to be no set in the house. The young people among themselves called him a ninny, and only the old general treated him with the most cordial simplicity, exhorting him at length to go see the little giraffe that had just been born at the zoo. Once the visitors began to come, appearing every evening, now in various combinations, Luzhin was unable to be alone with his fiancée for a single moment, and his struggle with them, his efforts to penetrate through the thick of them to her, immediately took on a tinge of chess. However, it proved impossible to overcome them. More and more of them would appear, and he fancied it was they, these numberless faceless visitors, who densely and hotly surrounded him during the hours of the tournament. An explanation of all that was happening came one morning when he was sitting on a chair in the middle of his hotel room and trying to concentrate his thoughts on one thing alone. Yesterday he had won his 10th point, and today he had to beat Moser. Suddenly, his fiancée entered the room.
"Just like a little idol," she laughed, "sitting in the middle while sacrificial gifts are brought to him."
She stretched out a box of chocolates to him, and suddenly the laughter disappeared from her face.
"Luzhin?" she cried. "Luzhin, wake up! What's the matter with you?"
"Are you real?"
asked Luzhin, softly and unbelievingly.
"Of course I'm real. What a thing to do, putting your chair in the middle of the room and sitting there. If you don't rouse yourself immediately, I'm leaving."
Luzhin obediently roused himself, moving his shoulders and head about, then transferred his seat to the couch, and a happiness that was not quite sure of itself, not quite settled, shone and swam in his eyes.
"Tell me, when will this end?" she asked. "How many games to go?"
"Three," replied Luzhin. "I read today in the newspaper that you're bound to win the tournament, that this time you're playing extraordinarily."
"But there's Turati,"
said Luzhin, and raised his finger.
"I feel sick to my stomach," he added mournfully.
"Then no candies for you," she said quickly, and tucked the square package under her arm again.
"Luzhin, I'm going to call a doctor. You'll simply die if it goes on like this."
"No, no," he said sleepily. "It's already past. There's no need for a doctor."
"It worries me. That means till Friday, till Saturday, this hell. And at home, things are pretty grim. Everyone's agreed with Mama that I mustn't marry you. Why were you feeling sick? Have you eaten something or other?"
"It's gone, completely,"
muttered Luzhin, and put his head down on her shoulder.
"You're simply very tired, poor boy. Are you really going to play today?"
"At 3 o'clock, against Moser. In general, I'm playing, how did they put it?"
"Extraordinarily," she smiled.
The head lying on her shoulder was large, heavy, a precious apparatus with a complex, mysterious mechanism. A minute later, she noticed that he had fallen asleep, and she began to think how to transfer his head now to some cushion or other. With extremely careful movements, she managed to do it. He was now half lying on the couch, uncomfortably doubled up, and the head on the pillow was waxen. For a moment, she was seized with horror, lest he had died suddenly, and she even felt his wrist, which was soft and warm. When she straightened up, she felt a twinge of pain in her shoulder.
"A heavy head," she whispered as she looked at the sleeper, and quietly left the room, taking her unsuccessful present with her.
She asked the chambermaid she met in the corridor to wake Lucian in an hour, and, descending the stairs soundlessly, she set off through sunlit streets to the tennis club, and caught herself still trying not to make a noise or any sharp movements. The chambermaid did not have to wake Lucian. He awoke by himself, and immediately made strenuous efforts to recall the delightful dream he had dreamed, knowing from experience that if you didn't begin immediately to recall it, later would be too late. He had dreamed he was sitting strangely in the middle of the room, and suddenly, with the absurd and blissful suddenness usual in dreams, his fiancée entered holding out a package tied with red ribbon. She was dressed also in the style of dreams, in a white dress and soundless white shoes. He wanted to embrace her, but suddenly felt sick. His head whirled, and she, in the meantime, related that the newspapers were writing extraordinary things about him, but that her mother still did not want them to marry. Probably there was much more of this and that, but his memory failed to overtake what was receding, and trying at least not to disperse what he had managed to wrest from his dream, Lucian stirred cautiously, smoothed down his hair, and rang for dinner to be brought. After dinner, he had to play, and that day the universe of chess concepts revealed an awesome power. He played 4 hours without pause and won, but when he was already sitting in the taxi, he forgot on the way where it was he was going, what postcard address he had given the driver to read, and waited with interest to see where the car would stop. The house, however, he recognized, and again there were guests, guests. But here, Lucian realized that he had simply returned to his recent dream, for his fiancée asked him in a whisper,
"Well, how are you? Has the sickness gone?"
And how could she have known about this in real life?
"We're living in a fine dream," he said to her softly. "Now I understand everything."
He looked about him and saw the table and the faces of people sitting there, their reflection in the samovar, in a special samovarian perspective, and added with tremendous relief,
"So this too is a dream? These people are a dream? Well, well." "Quiet, quiet, what are you babbling about?" she whispered anxiously,
and Lucian thought she was right. One should not scare off a dream. Let them sit there, these people, for the time being. But the most remarkable thing about this dream was that all around, evidently, was Russia, which the sleeper himself had left ages ago. The inhabitants of the dream, gay people drinking tea, were conversing in Russian, and the sugar bowl was identical with the one from which he had spooned powdered sugar on the veranda on a scarlet summer evening many years ago. Lucian noted this return to Russia with interest, with pleasure. It diverted him, especially as the witty repetition of a particular combination
which occurs, for example, when a strictly problem idea, long since discovered in theory, is repeated in a striking guise on the board in live play. The whole time, however, now feebly, now sharply, shadows of his real chess life would show through this dream, and finally it broke through, and it was simply night in the hotel, chess thoughts, chess insomnia, and meditations on the drastic defense he had invented to counter Turati's opening. He was wide awake, and his mind worked clearly, purged of all dross and aware that everything apart from chess was only an enchanting dream, in which, like the golden haze of the moon, the image of a sweet, clear-eyed maiden with bare arms dissolved and melted. The rays of his consciousness, which were wont to disperse when they came into contact with the incompletely intelligible world surrounding him, thereby losing one half of their force, had grown stronger and more concentrated now that this world had dissolved into a mirage, and there was no longer any need to worry about it. Real life, chess life, was orderly, clear-cut, and rich in adventure. And Lucian noted with pride how easy it was for him to reign in this life, and the way everything obeyed his will and bowed to his schemes. Some of his games at the Berlin tournament had been even then termed immortal by connoisseurs. He had won one after sacrificing in succession his queen, a rook, and a knight. In another, he had placed a pawn in such a dynamic position that it had acquired an absolutely monstrous force, and had continued to grow and swell, balefully for his opponent, like a furuncle in the tenderest part of the board. And finally, in a third game, by means of an apparently absurd move that provoked a murmuring among the spectators, Lucian constructed an elaborate trap for his opponent that the latter divined too late. In these games, and in all the others that he played at this unforgettable tournament, he manifested a stunning clarity of thought, a merciless logic. But Turati also played brilliantly. Turati also scored point after point, somewhat hypnotizing his opponents with the boldness of his imagination, and trusting too much, perhaps, to the chess luck that till now had never deserted him. His meeting with Lucian was to decide who would get first prize, and there were those who said that the limpidity and lightness of Lucian's thought would prevail over the Italian's tumultuous fantasy, and there were those who forecast that the fiery, swift-swooping Turati would defeat the far-sighted Russian player. And the day of their meeting arrived. Lucian awoke, fully dressed, even wearing his overcoat. He looked at his watch, rose hastily, and put on his hat, which had been lying in the middle of the room. At this point, he recollected himself and looked round the room, trying to understand what exactly he had slept on. His bed was unrumpled, and the velvet of the couch was completely smooth. The only thing he knew for sure was that from time immemorial he had been playing chess, and in the darkness of his memory, as in two mirrors reflecting a candle, there was only a vista of converging lights with Lucian sitting at a chessboard, and again Lucian at a chessboard, only smaller, and then smaller still, and so on an infinity of times. But he was late. He was late, and he had to hurry. He swiftly opened the door and stopped in bewilderment. According to his concept of things, the chess hall and his table and the waiting Turati should have been right here. Instead of this, he saw an empty corridor and a staircase beyond it. Suddenly, from that direction, from the stairs, appeared a swiftly running little man who caught sight of Lucian and spread out his hands.
"Maestro!" he exclaimed. "What is this? They're waiting for you! They're waiting for you, Maestro! I telephoned you 3 times, and they said you didn't answer their knocks. Signor Turati has been at his post a long time."
"They removed it," said Lucian sourly, pointing to the empty corridor with his cane. How was I to know that everything would be removed?
If you don't feel well, began the little man, looking sadly at Lucian's pale, glistening face.
Well, take me there,
cried Lucian in a shrill voice, and banged his cane on the floor.
With pleasure, muttered the other distractedly.
His gaze concentrated on the little overcoat with its raised collar running in front of him. Lucian began to conquer the incomprehensible space.
We'll go on foot, said his guide. It's exactly a minute's walk.
With a feeling of relief, Lucian recognized the revolving doors of the café, and then the staircase, and finally he saw what he had been looking for in the hotel corridor. Upon entering, he immediately felt fullness of life, calm, clarity, and confidence.
There's a big victory coming, he said loudly,
and a crowd of dim people parted in order to let him through.
Tard, tard, très tard,
jabbered Tarotti, materializing suddenly and shaking his head.
Avanti,
said Lucian, and laughed. A table appeared between them, and upon it was a board with pieces set out ready for battle. Lucian took a cigarette from his waistcoat pocket and unconsciously lit up. At this point, a strange thing happened. Tarotti, although having white, did not launch his famous opening, and the defense Lucian had worked out proved an utter waste. Whether because Tarotti had anticipated possible complications, or else had simply decided to play warily, knowing the calm strength which Lucian had revealed at this tournament, he began in the most banal way. Lucian momentarily regretted the work done in vain, but nevertheless he was glad. This gave him more freedom. Moreover, Tarotti was evidently afraid of him. On the other hand, there was undoubtedly some trick concealed in the innocent jejune opening proposed by Tarotti, and Lucian settled down to play with particular care. At first, it went softly, softly, like muted violins. The players occupied their positions cautiously, moving this and that up, but doing it politely, without the slightest sign of a threat. And if there was any threat, it was entirely conventional, more like a hint to one's opponent that over there he would do well to build a cover. And the opponent would smile, as if all this were an insignificant joke, and strengthen the proper place, and himself move forward a fraction. Then, without the least warning, a chord sang out tenderly. This was one of Tarotti's forces, occupying a diagonal line. But forthwith a trace of melody very softly manifested itself on Lucian's side also. For a moment, mysterious possibilities were quivering, and then all was quiet again. Tarotti retreated, drew in. And once more, for a while, both opponents, as if having no intention of advancing, occupied themselves with sprucing up their own squares, nursing, shifting, smoothing things down at home. And then there was another sudden flare-up, a swift combination of sounds. Two small forces collided, and both were immediately swept away. A momentary, masterly motion of the fingers, and Lucian removed and placed on the table beside him what was no longer an incorporeal force, but a heavy yellow pawn. Tarotti's fingers flashed in the air, and an inert black pawn with a gleam of light on its head was in turn lowered onto the table. And having got rid of these two chess quantities that had so suddenly turned into wood, the players seemed to calm down and forget the momentary flare-up. The vibration in this part of the board, however, had not yet quite died down. Something was still endeavoring to take shape. But these sounds did not succeed in establishing the desired relationship. Some other deep, dark note chimed elsewhere, and both players abandoned the still quivering square and became interested in another part of the board. But here, too, everything ended abortively. The weightiest elements on the board called to one another several times with trumpet voices, and again there was an exchange, and again two chess forces were transformed into carved, brightly lacquered dummies. And then there was a long, long interval of thought, during which Lusion bred from one spot on the board and lost a dozen illusionary games in succession. And then his fingers groped for and found a bewitching, brittle, crystalline combination, which, with a gentle tinkle, disintegrated at Tirati's first reply. But neither was Tirati able to do anything after that, and, playing for time is merciless in the universe of chess, both opponents repeated the same two moves, threat and defense, threat and defense. But meanwhile, both kept thinking of a most tricky conceit that had nothing in common with these mechanical moves. And Tirati finally decided on this combination, and immediately a kind of musical tempest overwhelmed the board, and Lusion searched stubbornly in it for the tiny clear note that he needed in order in his turn to swell it out into a thunderous harmony. Now everything on the board breathed with life. Everything was concentrated on a single idea, was rolled up tighter and tighter. For a moment, the disappearance of two pieces eased the situation, and then again agitato. Lusion's thought roamed through entrancing and terrible labyrinths, meeting there now and then the anxious thought of Tirati, who sought the same thing as he. Both realized simultaneously that White was not destined to develop his scheme any further, that he was on the brink of losing rhythm. Tirati hastened to propose an exchange, and the number of forces on the board was again reduced. New possibilities appeared, but still no one could say which side had the advantage. Lusion, preparing an attack for which it was first necessary to explore a maze of variations, where his every step aroused a perilous echo, began a long meditation. He needed, it seemed, to make one last prodigious effort, and he would find the secret move leading to victory. Suddenly, something occurred outside his being, a scorching pain, and he let out a loud cry, shaking his hand, stung by the flame of a match, which he had lit and forgotten to apply to his cigarette. The pain immediately passed, but in the fiery gap, he had seen something unbearably awesome, the full horror of the abysmal depths of chess. He glanced at the chessboard, and his brain wilted from hitherto unprecedented weariness. But the chessmen were pitiless. They held and absorbed him. There was horror in this, but in this also was the soul harmony. For what else exists in the world besides chess? Fog, the unknown, non-being. He noticed that Tirati was no longer sitting. He stood, stretching himself.
"Adjournment, maestro," said a voice from behind. "Note down your next move."
No, not yet,"
said Lusion pleadingly, his eyes searching for the person who spoke.
"That's all for today,"
the same voice went on, again from behind. A gyratory kind of voice. Lusion wanted to stand up, but was unable to. He saw that he had moved backwards, somewhere together with his chair, and that people had hurled themselves rapaciously upon the position on the chessboard where the whole of his life had just been, and were wrangling and shouting as they nimbly moved the pieces this way and that. He again tried to stand up, and again was unable to.
Why?
He said plaintively, trying to distinguish the board between the narrow black backs bent over it. They dwindled completely away and disappeared. On the board, the pieces were mixed up now and stood about in disorderly groups. A phantom went by, stopped, and began swiftly to stow the pieces away in a tiny coffin.
"It's all over,"
said Lusion, and groaning from the effort, wrenched himself out of the chair. A few phantoms still stood about discussing something. It was cold and fairly dark. Phantoms were carrying off the boards and chairs. Tortuous and transparent chess images roamed about in the air wherever you looked, and Lucian, realizing that he had got stuck, that he had lost his way in one of the combinations he had so recently pondered, made a desperate attempt to free himself, to break out somewhere, even if into non-existence.
"Let's go! Let's go!" cried someone, and disappeared with a bang.
He remained alone. His vision became darker and darker, and in relation to every vague object in the hall, he stood in check. He had to escape. He moved, the whole of his fat body shaking, and was completely unable to imagine what people did in order to get out of a room. And yet there should be a simple method. Abruptly, a black shade with a white breast began to hover about him, offering him his coat and hat.
"Why is this necessary?"
he muttered, getting into the sleeves and revolving together with the obliging ghost.
"This way," said the ghost briskly, and Lucian stepped forward and out of the terrible hall.
Catching sight of the stairs, he began to creep upward, but then changed his mind and went down, since it was easier to descend than to climb up. He found himself in a smoky establishment where noisy phantoms were sitting. An attack was developing in every corner, and pushing aside tables, a bucket with a gold-necked glass pawn sticking out of it, and a drum that was beaten by an arched, thick-maned chestnut, he made his way to a gently revolving glass radiance and stopped, not knowing where to go next. People surrounded him and wanted to do something with him.
"Go away! Go away!"
a gruff voice kept repeating.
"But where?"
said Lucian, weeping.
"Go home,"
whispered another voice insinuatingly, and something pushed against Lucian's shoulder.
"What did you say?"
he asked again, suddenly ceasing to sob.
"Home, home,"
repeated the voice, and the glass radiance, taking hold of Lucian, threw him out into the cool dusk. Lucian smiled.
"Home," he said softly. "So that's the key to the combination."
And it was necessary to hurry. At any minute, these chest growths might ring him in again. For the time being, he was surrounded by twilight murk, thick cotton wool air. He asked a ghost slipping by how to get to the manor. The ghost did not understand and passed on.
"One moment,"
said Lucian, but it was already too late. Then, swinging his short arms, he quickened his step. A pale light sailed past and disintegrated with a mournful rustle. It was difficult, difficult to find one's way home in this yielding fog. Lucian felt he should keep left, and then there would be a big wood, and once in the wood he would easily find the path. Another shadow slipped by.
"Where's the wood? The wood?"
Lucian asked insistently. And since this word evoked no reply, he cast around for a synonym.
"Forest? Wald?"
he muttered.
"Park?"
he added indulgently. Then the shadow pointed to the left and disappeared from view. Upbraiding himself for his slowness, anticipating pursuit at any minute, Lucian strode off in the direction indicated. And indeed he was suddenly surrounded by trees. Ferns crepitated underfoot. It was quiet and damp. He sank down heavily on the ground and squatted there, for he was quite out of breath, and tears poured down his face. Presently he got up, removed a wet leaf from his knee, and after wandering among tree trunks for a short time, he found the familiar footpath.
"Marsh! Marsh!"
Lucian kept repeating, urging himself on as he walked over the sticky ground. He had already come halfway. Soon there would be the river and the sawmill, and then the manor house would peep through the bare bushes. He would hide there, and would live on the contents of large and small glass jars. The mysterious pursuit had been left far behind. You wouldn't catch him now. Oh, no. If only it were easier to breathe and one could get rid of this pain in the temples, this numbing pain. The path twisted through the wood and came out onto a transverse road, while farther on a river glinted in the darkness. He also saw a bridge and a dim pile of structures on the other side of it, and at first, for one moment, it seemed to him that over there against the dark sky was the familiar triangular roof of the manor with its black lightning conductor. But immediately he realized that this was some subtle ruse on the part of the chess gods, for the parapet of the bridge produced the rain-glistening, trembling shapes of great female figures, and a queer reflection danced on the river. He walked along the bank, trying to find another bridge, the bridge where you sink up to your ankles in sawdust. He looked for a long time, and finally, quite out of the way, he found a narrow, quiet little bridge, and thought that here at least he could cross peacefully. But on the other bank, everything was unfamiliar. Lights flashed past and shadows slid by. He knew the manor was somewhere here close by, but he was approaching it from an unfamiliar angle, and how difficult everything was. His legs, from hips to heels, were tightly filled with lead, the way the base of a chessman is weighted. Gradually, the lights disappeared, the phantoms grew sparser, and a wave of oppressive blackness washed over him. By the light of a last reflection, he made out a front garden and a couple of round bushes, and it seemed to him he recognized the miller's house. He stretched out a hand to the fence, but at this point, triumphant pain began to overwhelm him, pressing down from above on his skull, and it was as if he were becoming flatter and flatter, and then he soundlessly dissipated.